From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. In the past few months, voters watching Campaign 08 got to see the political rhetoric change from largely non-racial to racially charged. Maybe it was inevitable, but it still ticked off a lot of voters. Among the latest salvos, former Democratic vice presidential candidate Geraldine Ferraro just resigned as an advisor to the Clinton campaign. She said that Obama effectively had an advantage because he was black, and then, before her resignation, had this to say on Good Morning America.
The sad thing is that my comments have been taken so out of context and have been spun by the Obama campaign as racist that, you know, it's doing precisely what they don't want done. The sad thing is that my comments have been taken so out of context and have been spun by the Obama campaign as racist that, you know, it's doing precisely what they don't want done. It's going into the Democratic Party and dividing us even more.
If this sounds familiar, well, that's because it is. Ferraro made similar comments back in Jesse Jackson's 88 campaign, saying that if Jackson were not black, he wouldn't be in the race. And where's this debate over race headed? Given the resignation of a high-profile Obama advisor, how much do the campaigns have to wrangle their key supporters? With us now, Dr. Mary Frances Berry. She's a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. And Ron Walters. He's a professor of political science and the director of the African American Leadership Institute at the University of Maryland. He was an advisor in Reverend Jesse Jackson's presidential campaign. Welcome to you both.
Good to be with you.
So, Ron, we have a relatively long time before the Pennsylvania primary on April 22nd. Is this a glimpse of what we can expect for the next 6 weeks?
Well, I don't think so. I think there may be some backing away from some of this. I think it is not in the interest of the Democratic Party to fuel this sort of racial rhetoric. And as a matter of fact, you know, when you listen to this, you think about, well, where are the leaders of the party, the Howard Deans and some of the others who are really in leadership positions? You haven't heard them say anything. And it would seem to me that it would be in the interest of not only the Democrats but the Republicans to say that these campaigns should not be based upon either race bias or gender bias. And, you know, we live at the beginning of a new century, where the demographics indicate that we're going to have these kind of campaigns again. I mean, the people who are not white coming into positions where they're running to be candidates. And we have to have a standard which says to the American people the kind of campaign we want to run.
Well, let's listen to Obama's response to Ferraro's comments.
Yeah, I think if you pulled out a handbook of, you know, how to weigh your assets and liabilities in a presidential race, I don't think my name or my skin color would be in the asset column.
Mary, do you think that Senator Obama is striking the appropriate tone, just kind of saying, yeah, I disagree with you, but keeping it a little mellow? Should people even be that upset about this? Because a lot of people are really exercised over Geraldine Ferraro's remarks. I think we're having some technical difficulties. Dr. Berry, will...
As usual, I try to stand in the middle and end up getting probably getting pillared from both sides. But let me just say that I think both sides are being disingenuous in this whole thing. Race and gender are an issue because you've got a woman and a black guy running for president and going all the way for the first time in the Democratic Party. And everybody knows it's a black guy and it's a white woman, and you can see that. Race and gender are still important in our society when it comes to issues of discrimination, which nobody seems to want to discuss in this campaign. Also, as somebody who helped one of Jesse's guys, Frank Watkins, write the article that was in the Post for the 84 campaign, Washington Post, saying why a black man should run for president in 1984, I recall that one of the reasons why Jesse ran was because he was a black guy, and we thought that one of the things he could get was support from black people. That was true in 88, too, and to broaden it into a rainbow coalition. I think both sides are being disingenuous. As for Ferraro, while I don't think she's personally a racist, I don't have any evidence to say that she is, I think that she shouldn't have said what she said, even if it was to a little tiny newspaper somewhere that she thought nobody should notice, and it was well that she decided to just leave the campaign and say what she wants. As far as Obama is concerned, yes, it was his campaign who put out the statement widely. It was David Axelrod who did it. and who then, I guess, were anxious to get the Clinton campaign to have to dump Ferraro like they had to dump Samantha Powers. I think the issue is going to be discussed. The reason why you don't have Howard Dean saying anything or any of the leaders of the party is that they don't want to touch this issue, too, if it can disappear or go away, because it's a hot-button issue. So I don't think it's going to go away.
Ron, I'm actually going to play you a little bit more from Senator Clinton. She got rid of advisors before for making disparaging remarks about Barack Obama. And this time around, Ferraro made it clear that she resigned on her own initiative. But here's a little bit more from Senator Clinton.
Well, I don't agree with that. And I think it's important that, you know, we try to stay focused on the issues that matter to the American people. And both of us have had supporters and staff members who've gone over the line, and we have to rein them in and try to keep this, you know, on the issues.
When she says, I don't agree with that, she was referring to the idea that she should have done even more, that, you know, maybe she should have demanded that Ferraro resign before Ferraro did. Ron, when it comes to advisors, it's this weird situation where the advisors are proxies who can say things that the candidates can't. Up to a point. What is that point?
Well, I think up to the point where they really sort of get the candidate in trouble. And I think in this case, you even had some incidents where you've gotten the candidate in trouble. I think Donna Brazile, for example, in the Gore campaign, when she was the campaign manager, was forced to resign, and she had gotten the candidate in trouble. And that's what you have to do. But I believe that, you know, coming out of the Clinton administration, the Clinton campaign, you know, these things have been far too frequent. And as a strategist, it gives me the feeling that this is not all accidental. And so as much as people will try to sort of equalize what's going on in both campaigns, I don't think it's really quite that equal. I think that Barack Obama is vulnerable because he has tried to run a race-neutral campaign. He's not tried to run a campaign as a black man. And the fact that he is black, his campaign has tried to make incidental so that his supporters could see past his race into the issues. And so for him, it's a problem because he can't and doesn't really want to respond in racial terms to racial attacks. And that's one of the reasons why I think that the party should have an interest in trying to make sure that this thing is played upon, you know, on a level playing field. I think that these attacks are coming from the Clinton administration on a frequent basis. And I think that there's something in that that's more than sort of accidental, as I suggested.
I think that, even though I just explained, and Ron didn't controvert it, that this latest thing came from David Axelrod in his meeting with reporters, where he highlighted the Ferraro campaign and spread it far and wide and demanded that there be a response, which then got everybody talking about it on the radio and on the TV and everything else. He still keeps talking about all of the attacks being generated by one side or the other. I think that what has happened is that the Obama campaign has now tipped its toe into getting into this business of highlighting something somebody said about race. I don't think they should. I think they should stand back and do what he's been doing and run the kind of campaign he's been running, which has been successful, and not let himself get all involved and embroiled in it. If he would do that, I think it would die out. If he doesn't do it, and if he keeps on talking about it too, then, you know, there'll be both of them talking about it, and it won't go away.
Well, I think it's difficult to have it both ways, because has happened to the Obama campaign in the last 2 weeks is that it's been under attack from the McCain campaign, from the Clinton campaign, and particularly from the media. And the argument there is that he's not been tough enough, that he doesn't fight back against these attacks. And so when he does fight back against a very obvious, deleterious attack, he really shouldn't be taken to task for that. I think this is part of his way of saying, look, I'm in this race, I want to fend off these negative attacks, but I really am in this race to talk about a new kind of politics, because this is the kind of politics that's really kept us from dealing with many of these problems in the past.
Just quickly, Mary and then Ron, what do you think has changed since the time when Reverend Jesse Jackson ran for president?
Oh, I think that you have lots more white people who are wanting to get beyond the question of race and are looking at a candidate who typifies a lot of the American dream of success. I mean, he's got all the right credentials. He's an attractive black man. He's smart. What is there not to like about him? And so the demographics have changed since Jesse ran. And one group we're leaving out of all this, of course, as usual, is the Latinos and what they think about everything since they are becoming a majority. But I think you have many, many more whites who are willing to support Obama and who see him as an attractive candidate. And it's much beyond the Rainbow Coalition that Jesse talked about in 1988. It's just yearning.
Let me get Ron in here. What do you think? Have things changed quite a bit?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think the problem that Jesse had was that he was perceived, coming out of the civil rights movement, as a black candidate, quote-unquote. Barack Obama, of course, doesn't have that background. And as I said, he's tried to neutralize race so that people wouldn't sort of put him in a pigeonhole the way that, you know, people have temptation to do in this country. So, but I think Mary's certainly right that far more people, particularly the younger generation, both whites and Hispanics, are far more willing to look at someone on the merits and support their campaign. And I think also, I think whites, we're ready now, I think, to get past a lot of the deep ideological divisions in this country. And I think that's the message of his campaign that Geraldine Ferraro missed.
Ron,
she put it on race, but really it is an historic moment of change that's driving this campaign and not just Barack Obama.
Ron and Mary, thanks for joining us.
Okay, thank you for us.
Ron Walters is a professor of political science at the University of Maryland, and Dr. Mary Frances Berry is a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Is it all just in your head? Psychiatrists are still arguing over how much your brain's chemistry affects the way you feel and act. Serotonin and dopamine are just two of the chemicals that your body generates to regulate your moods. Drugs and therapy can be used to keep things in balance, but a lot of African Americans still steer clear of antidepressants and other medications. Many of us won't step foot in a psychiatrist's office. In a few minutes, I'll talk with best-selling author Rebecca Walker about her experience on antidepressants, which she took even while she was pregnant. But first, we'll dive into a discussion on how brain chemistry works and how everything from sunlight to the strength of your local community can affect your mental health. Dr. Carl Bell is president and CEO of the Community Mental Health Council in Chicago. He's also a clinical professor of psychiatry and public health at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Dr. Bell, welcome to News and Notes.
Thank you.
So let's talk basics. In simple terms, how does our brain chemistry affect our moods?
Well, you know, the best example of that would be alcohol in the brain, because that's certainly an issue of brain chemistry. Alcohol gets in the brain, and it creates all kinds of problems. And because of that, psychiatrists, physicians have often tried to figure out what's going on that creates mental disorders. Currently, we've got a limited amount of absolute specific evidence that brain chemistry causes mental disorders, but we sort of get this idea because we're prescribing people medications that clearly change brain chemistry, and as a result, we see them get better and we see their mental disorders improve. So that's really where this whole notion that psychiatric disorders stem from brain chemistry.
We live in an age of medication. Antidepressants like Prozac, Zoloft, and Paxil are household names. And there was a time not so long ago when psychiatric medication was used only in severe cases. We didn't see these ads running constantly on TV. If you're feeling down, if you're feeling mood disorder, social disorder, some other disorder. So why did things change so that these medications were widely prescribed, easy to get if you have insurance? What are the upsides and downsides of living in a time when antidepressants are actually the most commonly prescribed drugs in the United States?
Well, if you look at any well-done epidemiologic studies, that is studies which count the number of people who have depression, for example, Ron Kessler's work out at Harvard, what we learn is that 20 out of 100,000 people have a clinically needed to be treated major depression. And so the reality is, you know, there's a lot of denial in this country that people get ill mentally. And as a result, what we've actually done, if you look historically, is that we have undertreated these conditions. If you look at the numbers of people who are on medication for high blood pressure, diabetes, it's high. And the same is true for psychiatric disorders. except people don't want to believe that they're mentally ill.
I understand that you're someone who, among other things, does martial arts in order to keep yourself, I'm sure, not just in physical shape, but mental shape.
Absolutely.
How do things like how much we exercise, what we do, for mental stimulation, how do all of those factors affect our brain chemistry, our ability to stay healthy?
Well, what we're learning out, because part of the reason that these medications are being prescribed like they are, we got into the brain during the decade of the brain, and we are now producing medications that we actually know what they're doing and where they go, as opposed to just sort of guessing. We're also learning that, for example, if you have an alligator brain problem, and I'm breaking this down rather than being technical.
What does that mean, an alligator brain?
Alligator brain are motor neuron centers below the supratentorium of the brain. And so I call it alligator brain just to keep the conversation understandable.
Well, I still want to, I have to ask about this because that's, alligator brain is super simple, but I still don't get it. Do you mean like the basic functions of life?
Ganglion, reflexes, breathing,
right.
Motor functions.
So just the very, very basics.
Functions, the fight, flight, or freeze systems of the brain.
Got it.
That animal nature that we talk about.
Right.
And then you have the computer brain or the frontal cingulate gyrus of the frontal lobes, which I call the computer brain just to keep it simple. And what we find is that people who have Tourette's syndrome, which is a disorder of the lower motor neuron and basal ganglion and the like parts of the brain, and they curse and they have tics and they have these jerky movements. What we find that if people develop their frontal lobes and their cortex and they do concentration and attentional things like meditation in martial arts, they can control their symptoms. We know, for example, that if people are producing, we're getting into genetics, so we know that if people have short chromosomes in certain of their chromosomes, they're more likely to be vulnerable to post-traumatic stress disorder. But if they are in an environment which is loving and nurturing, that genetic predisposition does not manifest. The same is true for antisocial personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, where people are traumatized, and so they grow up with a supercharged alligator brain. They're in a fight-or-flight state constantly. But if they can get their frontal lobes trained, and as their frontal lobes develop, that computer brain develops, they're able to be discriminatory about whether to fight or flight, or there's no threat. So we're actually learning a great, great deal. Psychiatry, if you look historically, we used to have problems of mental retardation called phenylketonuria, a genetic disorder that absolutely causes brain chemistry problems, because the brain, the body cannot metabolize phenylalanine, which is an amino acid that's commonly occurring in food. So if you pick up a diet cola, it says, warning, phenylketonurics, don't use this product. It's got phenylalanine in it, and your body can't digest it, and if you use this product, you'll become retarded. We don't see cretinism anymore. Just left the Institute of Medicine's Committee on the Prevention of Mental Disorders, Substance Abuse, and Problem Behaviors in Children, Adolescents, and Young Adults, and we're now having serious conversations about the prevention of schizophrenia, the prevention of depression, the prevention of postpartum depression. There's a bill in Congress to start screening women who deliver for this, because if you put those women in social context and in supportive, emotional, warm, loving context where there's an environment that stimulates and nurtures, they don't see the manifestation of this postpartum depression.
Well, Dr. Bell, this is a perfect chance for me to bring in our other guest, Rebecca Walker. Rebecca Walker's latest book is Baby Love, and that memoir tracks her emotional and spiritual growth during her pregnancy and after the birth of her son. One of the many questions she had to ask herself was, will I keep taking antidepressants while I'm pregnant? Rebecca's with us now. Rebecca, thanks for coming on.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Farai. It's so great to be here.
So let's back up just a little bit. You have been an activist for years. You wrote another memoir about your life called Black, White, and Jewish. And like a lot of strong, smart people, I'm sure you were always on the go, under a lot of stress. Tell me briefly about when and why you started taking antidepressants.
Well, first, I want to just say it's so wonderful to be doing this program because we really do need to raise awareness about how important mental health is, especially in the African-American community. And thank you so much, Dr. Bell, for all of your work and for being so clear and articulate and historically present. I mean, this is a critical discussion. I grew up, like many people in my generation, as a child of divorce, moving back and forth between different communities. And I think that created in me a kind of fragmented sense of self. And as a result, I had serious social anxieties about how to behave in different cultural environments, how to negotiate who I was in relation to other people. I also had a hereditary predisposition to depression. You know, run in my family for generations untreated. And at a certain point, I realized that I needed support and that I had been in therapy, you know, to work through some of my familial issues. But after years of therapy, there was a sense that I kept going back to the same issues and going over them and over them. And I was kind of reifying the wound rather than finding a solution. And I decided after much consternation, because depression is still so stigmatized, and we are supposed to be able to just work it out on some level, but because as an African-American woman, a mixed-race woman, I was raised to believe that, you know, we've overcome so much, you know, why, you know, we shouldn't need to get any help. You know, on my father's side, we lived through the Holocaust. On my mother's side, we lived through slavery. You know, if they could get through all of that growing up the way I did, you know, please, you know, you know, I had an easy life.
You don't have any problems compared.
Right,
that,
exactly.
That mentality.
Yes. Well, so I finally decided to go to a psychiatrist, and he was really wonderful, very good. He was a very good diagnostician, however you say it. I think that the diagnosis aspect of psychiatry is so important, and it's such an important skill. And we started to work together, and through medication, I began to feel, you know, like a normal, stable human being. And that, you know, was a very important aspect of my development.
And you got into a relationship with the man who has become your life partner. Became pregnant, and then you had to face this question, do I continue medication while I'm pregnant? How stressful was that conversation you had to have with yourself and your doctor, and how did you finally make a decision?
Oh, it was brutal. I mean,
it's a big question.
Oh, it was terrible, and I agonized over it. I, you know, talked very intensely with my doctor and my partner about all of the different antidepressants and which I could take that would be the least potentially damaging to my newborn, the baby that was growing inside of me, and which would be best for me at the same time, because I finally had to admit to myself that there was the chance that if I just stopped taking my antidepressants that I would fall into a depression that would make me not want the baby at all and not be able to have a healthy relationship with him.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to really decide that my mental health was as important as his biological health. And so I made certain trade-offs. I stayed on my medication throughout the pregnancy, but then when it was time to nurse, I decided that I could only expose him to my milk, which had very small traces, but still I felt I could only expose him for a few months in terms of my conscience, and then I would have to switch over to formula because I wanted to find some kind of balance. But it was a very, very difficult decision.
Mm-hmm.
And one I still grapple with, you know, because the drug I was on has a slight chance of creating seizures in children who were exposed to it in the womb. And whenever I see my son getting a little bit hyper, you know, I always think, oh, you know.
Yeah.
You know.
But so far, so good.
Well, he's a beautiful, wonderful child. He does get a little hyper, and who knows if that's traces of the medicine or it's just he's a normal three-year-old, you know.
Yeah, but it's probably toddlerhood and, you know.
Yeah. Well, but I do have to say that I wonder.
Well, Dr. Bell, have you ever had to lead people through these kinds of discussions?
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding? Yeah, it's hard. It's a hell of a decision to make. You talk to the person about it because, you know, you can't be the boss of somebody. You got to do informed consent. So, you know, all this paranoia that black folk have about Tuskegee, and doctors are scared of two things: hurting somebody, which is number one, and being sued. And as a result, plus we didn't go to medical school to hurt people, you know. So you talk to people, and you just heard a beautiful explanation of thinking about it and trying to figure it out. The patients that I have had to do that with, I've seen, as a matter of fact, one of their children came in here who is now in their PhD psychology program that had grown up. And walked in my office talking about, I remember seeing you when I was 5 years old. Scared me to death, you know. But she was doing fine. So I've never seen, and I've looked, mind you, in the children who I've been treating with antidepressant medications and other medications. The biggest worry, of course, are the mood stabilizers, the anticonvulsive mood stabilizers in terms of pregnancy.
Well, give me a quick example of a couple of drugs that would fall in that category.
Well, any drugs that people use to treat manic depressive illness or bipolar disorder.
Those have a higher risk. Well, let me go back to Rebecca. We don't have much time left between the both of you, but Rebecca, I want you to give me a sense of what else you think can be done to keep yourself mentally healthy. I know that you're someone who has spent a lot of time with spirituality. What else do you think keeps you centered?
Very good question. I've always been, well, for the last 15 years, I've been a student of Buddhism, and that has helped a great deal. The tradition that I have studied, Vajrayana Buddhism, is really about being able to move into the parts of your mind that are wild, that fluctuate, that are unstable, and to exercise the muscle that stabilizes them, that can kind of remind you that underneath all of that static, there is indeed a calm that you can access at any time.
Outstanding.
And that's, I think that's what Dr. Bell is talking about, how to begin to retrain or to train that front part of your mind to interact with the reptilian, you know, so that you can actually forge new synapses. This idea that we actually can work inside of our mind to change the way
change
that
it from reacts. The inside. Dr. Bell, I have to ask Dr. Bell just quickly, almost out of time. What advice would you give someone who is seeking help?
I would tell black people, especially, that we rarely, if ever, get the benefit of modern medical technology. There are new medications, there are evidence-based psychotherapies, and I think even more importantly, we are on the verge of developing prevention strategies so that this stuff can be prevented the same way that we used to prevent polio and still prevent polio.
Well, Rebecca and Dr. Bell, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Farai. Thank you, Dr. Bell.
You're welcome. Good to hear you talk about your voyage.
Thanks. Dr. Carl Bell is president and CEO of the Community Mental Health Council. He's also clinical professor of psychiatry and public health at the University of Illinois Chicago. And Rebecca Walker is a writer living in Hawaii. Her latest book is a memoir titled Baby Love, and she joined me from the studios at KUOW in Seattle. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It's time to go into the world of sports with Tony Cox. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai.
So it feels like spring, and that can only mean that March Madness is right around the corner.
Well, Farai, you know you're right about that. And it really kicks into gear this Sunday with the selection of the NCAA basketball tournament seeds. 65 teams will be put into four regional brackets, and then they'll spend the next few weeks battling it out for a chance to go to the Final Four and ultimately On to the holy grail of college basketball, the championship, which will be decided this year in the great state of Texas at San Antonio on April the 7th. So, here to talk about it is Greg Lee, sports editor for the Boston Globe, and Dee Will from the sports blog Sports on My Mind. Hey, fellas.
How you doing, Tony?
Good to have you back. Before we talk about who's in and who's out of the big dance, let's look at some of the conferences, starting with the Big East. I'm coming to you first, Dee Will, because by my count, five Big East teams are ranked in the top 25 of the AP, with Georgetown at number 9, followed by Louisville, Notre Dame, Connecticut, and Marquette. But in the conference, these teams are much tighter. And since so many folks think that the Big East is already the toughest conference in the nation, I'm not one of them, by the way. I'm biased toward the Pac-10, but never mind that. How many teams, Dee Will, do you think will come out of the Big East to go on to the tournament, and which ones are they going to be?
I'm actually not really sure. I know that Syracuse played their way out. Providence might have played its way in. There, teams have chances. If two or three teams make a run, who knows what's going to happen? Beyond the five, I really don't want to say, because anything could happen from here on out. Honestly, it's a crazy year.
That's what makes it really interesting, isn't it, Greg Lee?
Yeah, I think in the Big East tournament, you know, I was listening to Bob Knight yesterday on his debut on ESPN, and he said that from today to the rest of the Big East tournament, there's no upsets because the Big East is very balanced and there are a lot of strong teams, and I expect seven teams to be in that, you know, tournament.
Really, seven? That's a good number. Oh, well, what about? Let me. You don't agree with that, D. Will?
Hey, you know, I think Greg's probably right, and. I could see eight, I could see six, I could see seven, and, you know, it's just one of those seasons. And watch out for mid-majors teams getting in.
Well, remember, the ACC is on a down year, and you know, only probably going to have three definite teams from the ACC. So, right. You know, ACC is going down.
Well, what about the Pac-10? Let's come across the country. Mm-hmm. Are they a tougher conference than the Big East? Now, they've only got three ranked teams right now, UCLA at number three, Stanford and Washington State. But they've got a lot of schools that are dangerous, including USC and Arizona. Yeah. So how many Pac-10 teams do you think are going to make it, D-Will?
I can see up to six getting in. I can see USC getting in. If Oregon, if Oregon wins a couple games, they'll get in. If Arizona wins one more game, I think they'll get in, and that's going to be six.
That's a good number.
I agree with that. Arizona had the toughest schedule in the nation. They had a dozen losses, but there are a lot of quality losses, and they played a real tough schedule. So I think six teams will get in into the tournament.
Whose conference is tougher, Pac-10 or the Big East?
I think just the styles of play are so different. For the tournament play, when you're playing a more slow-down game, you tend to believe the Big East because they're more accustomed to the half-court sets. They're more accustomed. They have a lot of big men, a lot of good, strong front-court guys. In the Pac-10, it's a free-for-all going back and forth down the court and outscoring people. And in the tournament, that style of play doesn't really work. So I tend to, you know, go with the team with a big man and a half-court style that you're adaptable for the tournament.
Have you seen UCLA this year?
I was going to say, overall. Ben Howland.
Overall.
Okay.
Right. Overall. Yeah, overall, the Big East, yes. But the top teams, Washington State and UCLA, play East Coast ball, and that makes them dangerous.
They absolutely do. In fact, do you think that UCLA is, you know, they are still a prohibitive favorite to at least make it to their third straight NCAA Final Four?
I think they'll be there.
Yes, I concur. Yes, Ben Howland brought that East Coast game out to the West.
Yeah, he absolutely did. One more thing before we move on away from the men. Every year there are dark horse schools that slip in and surprise the big ones. Winthrop knocked off Notre Dame last year in the first round. Butler in the past. Troy in the past. Any sleepers in the tournament this year, D. Will?
Yes, Drake. Very dangerous
Drake,
team.
Yeah. Drake,
yes,
very
Butler,
dangerous.
Very dangerous. Butler and Drake are two of the most dangerous teams in the country that people relatively around the country don't know about.
All right.
Yeah, Drake's been in the top 10 most of the year, so they're not really a surprise, but to most people who don't really follow the game, it's going to be a surprise to them.
We didn't say anything about North Carolina or Duke or Memphis or Tennessee. Will they be there at the end?
Yes.
I'm not a big believer in Memphis yet, only because of the conference they play in. It's not one of the stronger conferences in the country, so I don't know if they can really turn it on and off. Tennessee, they play a good style of basketball. I still haven't really believed in them yet, but I know UNC will be there at the end.
All right.
Yes, UNC, definitely.
We've got the guys covered, so let's talk about the women. From number one to number five in the AP ratings, there are only two games in the loss column that separate number one Connecticut from number five Maryland, with North Carolina, Tennessee, and Stanford in between. Now, if Connecticut goes on to win it all, guys, it would be their fifth title of this decade. And here's my question. Do the women get the love that they deserve now?
No.
You know, although this week there's some big news coming out in terms of how the recruiting of Maya Moore, the star freshman of UConn, this week, and that really shows that, you know, the women's game is getting a little nose in terms of, like, with the guys in terms of recruiting wars. They haven't had any real big news since, you know, the Dine Imus thing with Rutgers last year.
Well, you know, speaking of that, we had Rutgers coach Vivian Stringer on the show the other day talking with Farai about her school and the importance of the game for them, the same way it's important to the men. So here's what Coach Stringer said about making it to the championship game and what it meant to her team. Let's listen.
And I was so proud of them because I can remember seeing some of them cry or think that they couldn't, and then to see their faces on television or USA Today. And, you know, this is what it's all about. For us as leaders and as parents and as people that care about our young people, to take them to places that they don't think that they can go, have them accomplish those things, and then with that level of security and confidence, they can take on the world.
Well, you know, of course, 24 hours after that, Greg, the whole thing blew up in their faces with the Don Imus comment. So, a year later, not much different?
No, in terms of the coverage of women's basketball, no. But the biggest thing, though, is that they sell out their tickets for the Final Four. It's always sold out. It's a hard ticket to get. So it's really funny that they don't get that much coverage, but at the same time, the events, you know, at the Final Four always sells out.
All right, guys, let's move on to another topic, because spring training is winding down and America's favorite pastime is going global. While the Yankees and Tampa Bay Devil Rays were duking it out in St. Petersburg yesterday, the Dodgers and San Diego Padres are in Beijing, China, for an exhibition tour on what is becoming an annual rite of spring for the big leagues. Now, don't forget your passports, everybody. So how well is this international thing working out? I mean, we know places like the Dominican, Japan, Cuba, baseball hotbeds, all of them. But I'd never heard much about China. What about you, D-Will?
No, actually, there hasn't been much about China until recently. There are schools developing over there that are similar to the Dominican schools, but actually, they're just starting. This, I believe, is more due to the Olympics, and it's a showcase. And I think in the future, yes, China will be big on baseball. And as I said, as soon as they get the foundation in place for those schools, watch out.
You know, Greg, apparently China may become the next giant farm league for the big leagues, but there's no Yao Ming of baseball in China right now. No. So how do you think the Chinese are going to react and relate to the Americans?
Well, I think the thing that, you know, baseball is following what the NBA has done in terms of marketing the game, making it a global game. So I think as really with, you know, how the NBA went over to China and how the Chinese embraced the game, and now with Yao Ming there, it will take some time. But I think the Chinese will embrace the game of baseball once they learn the game, actually appreciate the game as Americans do. And I think, you know, the Chinese will, you know, follow suit like they have done with basketball.
Well, let me ask both of you whether or not you think that with all the U.S. baseball players' involvement in the news lately and the alleged steroid use that surrounds them, does that change the international perception of the game, do you think, both of you?
I don't think so. I think people in other countries are relatively sheltered from that, from all of that news. And so no, I don't think it'll have any bad effects or ill effects at all.
I don't think,
You don't either?
I agree with that. No, I don't think so.
All right, I'm going to talk about another baseball topic. I'm going to come to you first, Greg, because you're in Boston. Going back to yesterday's melee between the Yankees and the Devil Rays, maybe there will be a new rivalry in baseball now, replacing the Yankee Red Sox hatred with the Yankee Tampa Bay. What do you think about that?
That won't happen, especially the two major markets in Boston and New York. That will never happen. But although Tampa Bay, you know, they'll be a scrappy team this year. They want to show that they want to be respected. I mean, Tampa Bay has given the Red Sox fits the last couple of years, they've given the Yankees problems, and the D-Rays don't want to be respected as baseball players and not as a AAA team in Major League Baseball. So they're not going to take that stuff from the bigger market cities.
You know that picture of what's his name, Duncan, right? Was it Duncan?
Yeah,
that was sliding, with his foot right up, you know, right where it ought not have been. That's pretty nasty stuff there.
Yeah, with Joe Girardi down there as the manager, that brings a little New York flavor to it too. And there are a lot of lot of New York fans down in St. Pete's too. So if the Rays can develop a Yankee type style of play, they'll get a lot of converts down there.
It's going to be interesting. Yeah. One more thing about Boston: how legit are the Red Sox to defend their World Series crown?
As long as Josh Beckett is healthy and they'll have they have a great starting rotation. The hitting is always there, and the difference between the Red Sox and the rest of the league is that they have depth at the pitching position, which we know pitching is at a premium in baseball. So I think they have a legitimate shot to repeating.
Anybody in the NL give you any cause for concern?
In the National League?
Yeah.
No, not really. You know, the Cubs are talking noise again, but until they prove it in the playoffs, I don't believe that. American League is the best teams.
Let's wind up our sports bloggers roundtable for this week with this one last topic. You know, we always have to drop in on the NBA. There's no doubt that the Miami Heat are the worst team in the NBA, even though they won the title 2 years ago. And on Wednesday night, the two worst teams in the league got together. Somebody had to win, so the Knicks beat them and dropped the Heat to 52 losses against only 11 wins. So here's what happens. Pat Riley goes off on a sabbatical, supposedly shopping for college players. D-Wayne, their number one player, out for the rest of the season. The team is tanking. Is it okay for them to just cave in when they still have some season left ahead of them, D-Will?
Yeah, I don't think it's correct for Pat Riley to go scout players. I saw him in the stands at some games watching college players this past week. That's what they have a scouting team for. They have a crew of scouts that go do that. So allow your scouts to do that, Pat. As far as Dwayne Wade is concerned, it is an NBA tradition that when your star players are hurt and they could hurt themselves some more if the season's going bad, they kind of hang out and get well. But Riley, I think that's one of the poorest things that you could possibly do as a coach.
Do you agree with that?
I totally agree with that whole assessment. Dwayne Wade needed to be shut down. He's been playing hurt the entire year, and he's still a young guy. He's your centerpiece. You don't want to, take any chances of him tearing up anything because he's already injured. With Pat Riley, that is just a sign to, he doesn't trust his scouting department. And last I checked, he is the president and GM, so if you don't like your scouts, then fire them.
It's the most bizarre thing, but I guess losing just makes people do whatever they feel they have to do to get away. I appreciate it, gentlemen. Greg Lee, the online sports editor for the Boston Globe. He talked to us from WGBH Studios in Boston. D. Will writes for the blog Sports on My Mind. He spoke with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio in Burlington. Thanks, guys.
Okay, thank you, Tony.
No problem.
And thank you, Tony. That was NPR's Tony Cox. And now it's time for letters. Here to lend a helping hand digging through the mailbag is producer and editor Christopher Johnson. Hey, Christopher, how you doing?
I'm good, Farai. How you feeling?
Two thumbs up in a circle. So what's popping with the mail this week?
Well, on Monday, you spoke with economist and Bennett College president Julianne Malvo. She discussed the Urban League's new annual report, The State of Black America. Malvo wrote an essay for the report in which she explains her idea of the third burden.
African-American women are connected to African-American men, so that when African-American men are unfairly treated, it gives a burden to African-American women. The best example I can give is the fact that a million more black women work than black men. I would look at it as saying that African-American women have the burden of having to take on more economic slack in our community.
Now, we got lots of mail about that conversation. Tina Renard in St. Louis wrote us this. As far as the issue of black male employment opportunities go, I think we have to look at public education. I teach in a 99.99% African-American at-risk urban middle school where there is a huge problem with fighting. It seems to be the way to solving all their problems. It is difficult to deal with this effectively because parents are hard to get a hold of. Discipline problems are a major cause of lost instructional time, resulting in low test scores. We need to stop blaming society for all our problems and look at responsibility within the home first and then within ourselves.
Don Nichols also listened in on that discussion. He wrote this from Wildwood, Missouri. Let's all feel sorry for black women. Nice try, but they are not victims of anything but what they have brought upon themselves. Nothing will guarantee a good outcome for anyone, black, white, brown, or red, except education and hard work. There is no racism here. What is here is you guys playing the blame game. White people are not responsible for the failure of black people.
And we got some mail about our coverage of pop culture's influence on the White House race. In a couple of segments, we discussed how Saturday Night Live has satirized the elections and poked fun at the candidates.
Bonnie Benford in Reading, Pennsylvania isn't laughing. She wrote us this one. Quite frankly, I'm sick of you and your guests complaining about how unfair it is that Saturday Night Live seems to be favoring Hillary Clinton. For God's sake, give it a break. We are lucky to have two great Democratic candidates, and your favoring Obama shouldn't be so obvious to us listeners.
And last but never least, love, 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 AJ Stakowitz hit us up from over in Denver. He's been digging our series this month on blacks and mental health, and AJ says, I know it actually is a focus on mental health in the black community, but the information on the show is something that everyone can learn from. It is comforting just to hear it being talked about. I've been through some I've had and recovered from cancer. I've lost my father to alcoholism. I've been robbed at knife point, and that's just to name a few. But my suffering with depression has by far been the worst thing I've ever experienced. Thank you for dealing with this on your program.
AJ, thank you for sharing your story with us, and keep on keeping on.
And that's it for letters, but please keep yours coming.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us. And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name. Christopher, thanks.
You got it, Farai.
That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, it's our Reporters Roundtable, and Newsweek's Allison Samuels brings the drama straight from Hollywood's headlines.